and welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle. What has happened to the anti-war movement? There are plenty of wars being fought, though with far fewer protesters. Was the anti-war movement just really about the presidency of George W. Bush and not necessarily against war? To crosstalk if the anti-war movement has vanished, I'm joined by Angela Keaton in Los Angeles. She is antiwar.com development director and anti-war radio producer. Also in Los Angeles, we have Thaddeus Russell. He is a historian and author of A Renegade History of the United States. And in Ann Arbor, we cross to Michael Heaney. He is assistant professor of organizational studies and political science at the University of Michigan. Okay, crosstalk rules are in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. But first, let's have a look at the anti-war movement then and now.
What happened to the anti-war movement, so active just prior to Bush's war in Iraq? Mass demonstrations in the streets, on city squares, and in front of the White House. Where are they, brave fighters for peace? Activists adamantly opposed to military interventions have always tried to reflect public opinion and influence policymakers. How much has changed? The anti-Vietnam War movement made a major impact.
By 1968, faced with widespread public opposition to the war and troubling prospects in Vietnam, the Johnson administration halted the bombing of North Vietnam and stabilized the ground war. This policy reversal was the major turning point.
It would appear it's difficult to witness history repeat itself. Numbers show anti-war rallies have significantly decreased over the past years. Some claim this is because of the election of Barack Obama to the U.S. presidency. As a Democrat, he rose to power opposing the war in Iraq and promising to end it.
By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
Expectations were high when Obama entered office and after he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Nonetheless, on the sidelines of the Nobel Committee ceremony, anti-war activists expressed their concern.
This Peace Prize is a slap in the face to us, all of us! Yeah. All of us who have been working and sacrificing for true peace for years.
After 2 years in office, many do not see a difference between Barack Obama and George W. Bush, at least in terms of foreign policy. Obama inherited two wars, neither of which has ended. And the United States is now involved in military action in Libya. It would appear that the anti-war movement today has gone AWOL. Daria Chernyshova for Crosstalk, RT.
All right, I usually like to reward the person that had to get up earliest for this program, but we have two people from Los Angeles today. But I'm going to go to Angela anyway. I read antiwar.com every single day, many times a day. And you do a wonderful service. But you know, antiwar.com, that was something that really brought people together when Bush was going to war, an illegal war that he was pushing. And mainstream followed along. And now, and I think you're a wonderful success, but where is the anti-war movement today? We have a lot more war. If you read antiwar.com, the United States is contemplating military action in even more places right now beyond Libya. So Angela, what happened?
Well, and I owe one of these answers to one of our guests here today, but the sobering, unfortunate answer is the neoconservatives and nationalists were right. It was an anti-Bush movement more than it was an anti-war movement. And that's where it went. I mean, partisanship is so strong in the U.S., and Democrats are so wedded to Barack Obama and so afraid of weakening him, they will put up with any number of moral indecency to allow him to keep his vaunted position, including this situation. And also because Barack Obama had no public lead up to Libya, so there's no chance for organization either. The fact that Democrats are free to criticize Obama and the fact there's so little public debate on Libya says really terrible things about the future of democracy in the U.S. So I mean, this is the whole situation is a bit of a microcosm, a reflection of what's actually going on in the U.S. right now.
Thaddeus, if I can go to you also in Los Angeles, the empire has its appetite for war is insatiable. So was the anti-war movement really all about George W. Bush, as Angela pointed out, and I'm sure Michael is going to tell us in a few minutes. Go ahead.
I agree with everything that Angela said. I think that in large part, the anti-war movement during Bush was really about, unfortunately, about personality, in a sense. I mean, he was seen as sort of this disreputable, lowbrow Texan who was very crude in his ways. Well, what we've gotten is an imperialist who's actually very refined and very articulate and very effective. I would just say liberals now are basically the more effective and always have been the more effective imperialists than conservatives, mm-hmm. who usually tend to use brute force and very crude rhetoric. And so that, I think, is one reason, but we can talk about many others, for why there is no anti-war movement and why there are actually more wars now than before.
Well, Michael, you've written probably the most authoritative report on this to date. If you could give my audience the title of that report. But, I mean, you basically say it was really just about Bush, right?
Well, I think it's a little bit more than that. I would say that it's both about being anti-war and about being anti-Bush. So I believe that the people who participated in the anti-war movement were genuinely and earnestly anti-war, and that was the reason why they participated. But it was President George W. Bush that made the events seem so threatening. And once President Bush went away, people felt less threatened and were thus less likely to participate. I guess I would also add that the anti-war movement has not gone away completely, but rather it has gotten very small. So that what is really left is the hardcore, the highly organized, dedicated people. In other words, it's become a movement in abeyance now, rather than a really mass movement.
Michael, if I can stay with you, I mean, I want to just kind of press you a little bit. I mean, if it's really diminished in its numbers, I mean, then how can you say these people, the anti-war element, it seems a bit thin, really, there? I mean, you're just slightly against the war, or, you know, I'm against the war, this war. I mean, what I'm saying is, you know, the United States is constantly at war. It's bankrupting itself while others are making a fortune, and misery, unspeakable misery, that we caused, the United States causes so many places, and you just say people kind of walk away from it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's important to understand what motivates people's participation, ordinary people's participation in sort of mass protest events, and what gets them mobilized to get involved in politics. And really, it's a sense of threat. And it was during the Bush years that people felt very strongly, acutely threatened, and they felt the strong need to do something about it. Whereas now they don't feel quite as threatened, and that's why they don't participate as much.
Angela, what
do
you?
The way I like to explain it is.
Oh, go ahead. Keep going. Keep going. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. The way that I like to explain it is that there are a lot of issues that I take positions on where I disagree with my government. So, for example, I might disagree with my government's policies on criminal justice, and I do, and I disagree with my government's policies on the environment. But I often don't find myself mobilized to action on those issues. Now, the war was an issue that I personally was very mobilized against, but that was because of the stronger sense of threat in that area than in others.
Angela, what do you think about that? Because I guess you could argue that the average American citizen is probably even more threatened now by more wars, but the perception isn't there. How do we you know, square the circle on that?
Well, think about it for a second. In the beginning of, or towards the end of 2009, beginning of 2010, 63% of Americans were theoretically against the war in Afghanistan. But when you actually ask people what they vote on, only 2.5% voted and would vote the war being a deciding factor in how in what they did in the ballot box. It's not a bread and butter issue. I mean, this is the anti-war movement. This is the post-Vietnam era anti-war movement. It has no draft to coalesce around.
Right.
People don't know anyone who died in Afghanistan or Iraq. It's not. People are going to when they actually political action ultimately is about the pocketbook and their home life. And this doesn't, it's just not that important. You don't have to pay attention. You don't have to watch the war, the news in and out every day. It's not even in people's faces. So, I mean, it doesn't galvanize and grab people. So what Michael was saying about, there are people who are just not going to be moved to action on it.
Thaddeus, if I can, again, to kind of echo the point that Angela just made there, I mean, it's an empire that can fight its wars, but it doesn't have to necessarily stir up anybody's emotions, because that's exactly what they want to do.
I slightly disagree with Angela, okay. Although I agree with her in general on almost everything. I do think there was a significant anti-war movement during the Bush administration. I was at many demonstrations in New York that had hundreds of thousands of people at them. They were less than what happened during Vietnam, and she's absolutely right that a draft certainly right. provokes an anti-war movement. Great numbers of casualties provoke an anti-war movement. But what the point I want to make here today, and I think this is very important, is it's really about what happened with the left and liberals, which is that they merged their identity with the head of empire during the campaign and since. And that is why they have left the anti-war movement in droves, because now they are part of the empire. They have become a part of this global effort to remake the world in our image. And that is really the tragedy. The left and liberals in this country need to really take a close look at what they did with Obama and begin to psychologically distance themselves from him. They need to start saying, not in our name, which is what they used to say during Bush and during Vietnam, and they no longer say that.
Okay, Michael, if I go to you right before the break here, is it really a crisis of the left, as Thaddeus just pointed out?
I agree. I think it is a crisis, and I think that this is a real problem for Obama, because I think that a lot of liberals are actually quite unhappy with Obama and don't feel like they've really gotten what they've bargained for. And even though they may not be on the streets anymore, they're still dissatisfied. And that obviously cost Obama in the 2010 midterm elections. And I think there's a really good chance it's going to cost him in the presidential election.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on the anti-war movement. Stay with our team.
Welcome to the future, bringing you the latest in science and technology from around Russia. We've got the future covered.
Yes, my name is Daniel Schmidt. This is Julian Assange. We're here to make a short presentation about the WikiLeaks project.
The first step in the Fourth Estate is to get information out about the real world.
Julian works on fear and on anger.
Secrecy is the biggest enemy of democracy.
If I ever put any sources in danger, he would hunt me down and kill me. This is exactly one of the reasons why we left the project, because it has become more about this whole James Bond bullshit than about the actual information.
First, some thank yous to all the people around the world who had faith in me.
Welcome back to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're talking about the anti-war movement today. Before we went to the break here, it was pointed out, Michael pointed out, that the anti-war movement isn't gone. It's been diminished in numbers. Angela, if I can go to you, do you think it's getting a fair enough amount of coverage in the media? Is the media interested in this story? Because we could say commercial media would be interested in the story against Bush because, well, it was a story, and you could spin it in a lot of different ways, which they did. But it's not really something, it's not a product for commercial media in the United States really to look at anymore.
Well, why would it be a product? I mean, the anti-war movement needs to also be self-critical here and actually take a hard look at what it's done in its own practices to exclude as many people as possible and marginalize itself, both, and I mean no disrespect to either groups, but both ANSWER and United for Peace and Justice have both policies and practices that have made it very, very difficult for a broad-based mainstream anti-war movement to develop, one that has enough numbers to justify media coverage. An ANSWER rally, the ANSWER rallies now, and the last one I went to would have been March 20th here in Hollywood. The numbers aren't there, and when people from the outside try to work with the groups openly, I mean, there's no room for Ron Paul people there, there's no room for Christians, there's no room for many different groups, because ANSWER and United for Peace and Justice try to make the events too much about every other issue and not enough about a narrowly focused and serious anti-war movement, and that would be an anti-war movement that garners media coverage.
Thaddeus, do you agree with Angela on that? As I mean, you know, what is it? I'm not a socialist because I don't like ruling by committee. I mean, it sounds like, again, everything's connected to everything. I mean, if you don't stand on the right issue on, generic food, well, then you can't be part of the anti-war movement. It's the movement's just destroyed itself.
Well, okay. I think what Angela's saying is very, very important, and it's the one very exciting development in the last few years, although it's just beginning. So I'm a man of the left. I was raised by socialists in Berkeley. I've always been on the left, but I stumbled upon antiwar.com about 3 years ago and was blown away. I said, this is what the left should be doing. This is what the left should be saying. Libertarians and sort of paleocons, but especially libertarians like antiwar.com, like Ron Paul, have been the leading voices of the anti-war movement. They've been the most principled, the most consistent, no matter who's president. They've been saying again and again and again, these wars are disasters, the empire must end. And the left shuns them because they think they're either shills for corporations or they're racists or they don't care about people. How could they not care about people if they are the leading voices against killing people in our name? So I think that this is what Angela was saying is very important. I think the left-wing groups that used to dominate the anti-war movement need to welcome these very principled, very strong-willed people into the movement because they're our allies, and they are the best allies right now. It's a very exciting political dynamic. I was on, I'm going to be on a show with Ron Paul tonight in which he and I talk about this, that libertarians of his ilk and the left must come together. It is the only way, in fact, I believe, that these wars will end and that the empire will be brought home. The only way that will happen is if the left and libertarians come together around these issues.
Michael, if I can go to you, I mean, you know, I never would have, years ago, I never would have thought I'd turn into a fan of Patrick Buchanan, you know, I mean, on a lot of issues, domestic issues, but when he talks about foreign policy, I kind of stand up and listen. I mean, we have some unlikely bedfellows here, but to echo our two other guests here, I mean, there are commonalities. They wouldn't seem very obvious in the beginning, but very different ideological points of view can actually work together. They have enormous commonalities and synergies if they did work together.
Well, that's definitely true, and the anti-war movement has not only failed to reach out to these people, but it's failed to reach out to many demographic constituencies in the United States that have been opposed to war. So, for example, Latinos and African Americans are overwhelmingly opposed to war in public opinion. But the anti-war movement has done an inadequate job of integrating these groups into the mass movement. The one thing that I would say, if I could leave one message to the anti-war movement that I think that it should change its approach, is to put more emphasis on trying to get real expertise and facts out to the mass media about war. Probably my favorite anti-war scholar is Phyllis Bennis.
Oh yeah.
And I think that one of the things that we probably need is more people like Phyllis Bennis. I think the anti-war movement needs to do a much better job of getting the facts out to mainstream media. And in fact, I think that the mainstream media does a decent job of covering the anti-war protests themselves. What they don't do a good job of covering is the wars and what actually the United States military is actually doing. And I think if more people really understood what was going on with the U.S. military, it would be easier to galvanize public opinion against what we're doing.
Angela, I guess, you know, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but, you know, where's the antiwar.com TV? I mean, is it just really about resources? I mean, just being able to have those? Television's very expensive. Believe me, I know that. Okay. But, you know, to echo Michael's point, I mean, that's a very good point. You know, you can, if you look hard, to find what these wars really look like. But when it's really sanitized in mainstream media with all the patriotism and militainment and all of this other stuff that gunks up the work there, it is really hard to galvanize people when they don't really know to see the reality on the ground. You can read it at antiwar.com, but you don't always see it.
No, you're right. I mean, it's a much more intellectual experience, and it's not as easy, quick and easy with the facts that we push in people's faces. But over the past few years, there have been other major stories that completely knock the war off the front page. Michael had mentioned another interview. I mean, the first thing that happens, of course, is the healthcare situation. Well, that was 6 months without any real discussion about Afghanistan in the mainstream press. Anti-war TV, that's a wonderful idea. I just don't know where it is that people would know how to watch anti-war TV. One has to be looking for that information and actively seeking it out. And given that we're in a terrible, terrible economic crisis, it may not be people's first priority to say, gee, I wonder what's going on today in Yemen.
That's a very good point. Thaddeus, if I can go to you, again, I was talking about strange bedfellows. I mean, when people mention the Tea Party movement, I get a little worried because I hear some really, really nutty stuff. But fiscal conservatism, that's something I'll listen to. I'll sit down with any one of them and talk about it, okay? Might not agree with them. But why can't the anti-war movement find that group of people, or some of them, a strange bedfellow, I would honestly agree. But, you know, that's one way to get people to wake up to the cost of war. It's bankrupted the country. Is that a strategy?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, and that's certainly what Ron Paul has been saying. I will say that Ron Paul and Ralph Nader and Dennis Kucinich and Bernie Sanders and Cindy Sheehan have all worked together. Cindy Sheehan, I know, is friends with Angela and the antiwar.com people here. It is happening, and it can happen. And they come together around not just the atrocities of war and the human cost of it, but also the economic cost of it. I want to come back to one point we were talking about earlier, which is that how do you mobilize people? Well, you can't go into the ghetto and sort of convince people that they should be for or against something. I find that to be sort of paternalistic, actually. Mm-hmm. What is really, to me, the problem is Obama, because that is, most Americans are not political. Their version of politics, or the way they interact with politics, is really through the head of state. Mm-hmm. They don't actually pay much attention to anything else. There is a tremendous amount, I will come back to this again, of psychological identification with the President of the United States now. He is extremely popular among his base, which is large enough to get him elected. And they simply will go along to get along. When he said that Libya is a humanitarian intervention, they believed him because he's a good guy, they believe. We have to attack him on that basis. During Vietnam, every single day, a much more liberal Democratic president was being attacked daily by the anti-war movement, where they said, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? We have to start doing that kind of thing in the streets. The thing that just happened in San Francisco, where protesters finally confronted Obama about the torture of Bradley Manning, I thought was a wonderful thing. But that's really the first time people were sort of brazen and in his face. We have to start doing that. We have to start getting Americans to disassociate themselves from the head of empire.
What do you think about that, Michael? It's a very interesting point, and I can see the handlers of Obama showing him as, he's still not George W. Bush. That's something, a very powerful card they still play, because you have to admit, if you like the man or not, he is at least eloquent in some of the things humanitarian intervention, which is really hogwash. If you really looked at it carefully, if you watched antiwar.com, read there, you would have known that. How do we get away from that? I guess really addressing Michael's question.
Well, it's really hard to know what you can do to oppose somebody like Obama in a very direct way, because I think that the left is very confused about what to do with him right now. And so, really, I think that, you know, the opposition to Obama on his war policies, if it comes both from the left and from the right, that may be the most effective way of dealing with the issue. So you may see that the left doesn't come out in full force against Obama's war policies, but if some of the more reasonable elements of the right also do, then there'll be a general erosion of support. And as Obama looks forward to 2012, he may see the handwriting on the wall, and that may be what he needs to try to make a change.
Okay, Angela, I'm going to give you the last word on this program. What should the anti-war movement do now, and in relation to the 2012 presidential election?
Move past partisan politics. I'm not actually certain that electing a candidate, I'm not actually certain that our particular solutions can be addressed with heads of state. It's clear that whomever is in that seat is going to continue to, I mean, it has something invested in the idea of empire. So I'm not sure mobilization is important. I'm not sure, though, what role that's going to play in actual retail politics.
Okay, Michael, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you think the anti-war movement should do?
I think it needs to focus more on getting real facts out to people through the mass media.
All right. I don't know if that's an optimistic or pessimistic note there. Many thanks to my guests today in Los Angeles and in Ann Arbor, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.